My story. I went to graduate school for English. My PhD is in English. I went through my entire master's program doing more traditional kinds of English research. And it wasn't until I got to my PhD program, I was a couple of years in, and I wrote this paper on women in jazz. And I was looking at the location of women, because usually if you're talking about jazz, you see women as singers. And I was talking about women instrumentalists. So I wrote this paper, and I turned it in, and my professor said, you should submit this paper to some conferences. And I said, that sounds great. What conferences should I submit to? And she said, well, the Popular Culture Association and American Culture Association are great conferences. So I submitted it, and it was accepted, and I went to the conference. And there were people there that were presenting papers on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I said, what? How is this happening? Where? Like, they had their science fiction and fantasy area is the second largest area of that conference. The largest is film. They've got, I mean, any possible subject you can think of, like talking about the rhetoric of spaces, talking about, I can't even list it all. And I went for music that year because I was presenting on jazz. And then the next year I had started writing on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And that's where I met a lot of the people involved in the Whedon Studies Association. There's a Whedon Studies Association. They have a online peer-reviewed journal dedicated to the works of Joss Whedon. If you go to Slayage Online, you can look that up and see all sorts of... I mean, Buffy Studies and Whedon Studies is one of the largest, I guess, like sci-fi fantasy areas of academia, or of sci-fi fantasy academia, I should say. And they do a conference every 2 years called Slayage, which is one of the most amazing things ever. In 2014, I believe, will be in California. So I started writing my papers and gearing it towards that. That's what I'd always been interested in, but it wasn't something I realized that I could do right off the bat. I kind of went into it in a sideways sort of direction. From working in science fiction and fantasy studies, what I've really, I guess, learned is that there's really two approaches that you can take if it's something that you're interested in doing. And I've written it down as the independent approach and the traditional approach. And I guess that my route would have been more traditional. I went to graduate school. I got all of my degrees. I spent money that will take me another, you know, 50 or so years to pay back to the U.S. government.
Yep.
In order to do it.
Yeah, that's about
I picked a specific discipline. I picked English, which a discipline like English gives you a lot of leeway, but to a certain, only so much. I mean, I'm still usually confined to something like literature. My degree actually specializes in rhetoric and literary theory, so I get all sorts of, I can go anywhere I want with literary theory, but nobody wants to hire me as a faculty member with that, so there's that. Sorts of things that you have to take into consideration. You can get, once you pick a discipline, go to graduate school, you can get a career. You can get paid to do this by your department for the most part. I mean, I've gone to the Pop Culture Association and American Culture Association conference every year since like 2007 or 2008. And I've always had some sort of funding for that, which is really nice, especially when it's in like San Francisco, because I live here in Atlanta, and that's, yeah.
It's a bit of a flight.
Yes. and, you know, making that drive.
No.
But most importantly with that, you get access to resources like libraries. So you get access to your university library. Whether as a graduate student or as some sort of faculty or staff person. I'm actually staff at the moment at Georgia State University. And the other route I was thinking about was independent scholarship, which instead of going immediately into graduate school, you can just start writing papers, networking with people, submitting to conferences, looking up conferences to see what sorts of things you want to go into before you immediately start, you know, just giving the Department of Education, you know, all of your children before you have them. You could be a little bit more interdisciplinary with that, too. You don't have the publish or perish imperative, which in academia, if you're faculty and trying to be tenure track, you have to publish. You have no choice. You will never get promoted or a job or anything unless you publish. That's what academia cares about. So if you are any form of student, also that can be terribly frustrating, not just as a faculty member, to know that your faculty are just trying to publish papers in order to, you know, keep their job. You don't have the same sort of funding or resources, but you also don't have anybody to answer to in the same sorts of ways. So there's advantages and disadvantages to both routes. And it's really, I guess, like looking at how to become a science fiction scholar, the sorts of tracks that I came up with.
Yeah.
Would you?
I would say that those are definitely the two major tracks. Being an independent is, in many ways, I would say, a lot more satisfying emotionally. And to an extent, to not be beholden to your, you know, one department, your one thematic, you know, ideal is much, much nicer than having to, well, I have a specialization in this particular area, and so I must write whatever I write about that. I must write about, if I love the works of Timothy Zahn, or if I love the works of Isaac Asimov, if I love the works of Arthur Clarke, I have to write about Ray Bradbury from this particular specialization area and talk about how Ray Bradbury fits into that. But if they don't, then you can't really force it. I mean, you can maybe actually discover something, carve out an actual niche for yourself. But being an independent allows you to write on and work on and research on whatever you want, however you want to write and research on it. Being interdisciplinary about it means that you have more methodologies and more resources and different types at your disposal to do so. However, interdisciplinarity is often looked at in more traditional, and by traditional I mean stodgy, departments as dilettantism. Being an interdisciplinarian, you're gonna get asked, well, why don't you pick a specialization? Why don't you find one thing to do and do it well? And that can make it, in that regard, a little bit harder to get, as we were saying, to find a home with a place, to get somebody who wants you for all the things that you want to do. There are a few places out there. SUNY Binghamton has gotten interdisciplinary studies master's and PhD, where you basically craft your own program now. But that's, you know, that's a recent thing. That's not something that's always been there. But so far as, are these the major ways to go about working in and being able to work in science fiction studies? Absolutely. Like, you will either be able to start down a traditional path and find yourself there and find that you are able to draw in those things that you love into the academic career you have built yourself, or you can start out trying to do those things that you love as much as you want and drag in academic bits and pieces as you encounter them. For my part, I kind of went into like a mishmash of both. When I was in the course of my master's degree, I wanted to bring in elements to my thesis that were extraordinarily non-traditional elements. I wanted to bring in science fiction literature, and I wanted to bring in comic books. Mary Shelley and Mike Carey's Lucifer were the things that I wanted to weave into my thesis. And I had to do serious, serious work to get my thesis committee to even understand why they would be relevant to my topic. And that's something that I think needs to be discussed and understood at the outset as well, is that when you decide to do a sci-fi academia literature career, when you decide that you are going to work in bringing literary sources, not just into a literature or an English literature context, but into, for, in my instance, a philosophical context, you're going to have to convince a lot of people that that's not just your hobby. that that's not just the thing that you enjoy doing when you're not doing real work. And there are going to be those people who do understand it, who do embrace it, and who, if we're very lucky, work to build those things in which you can do more of it. But there are going to be, again, those in the more established, more traditional schools who look at it and who say, I don't see why you would do this. You have so much more reputable sources at your disposal. Why would you go about it this way? And recognizing that that's a possibility is, I think, something that will help you prepare yourself and to be able to craft in your own mind and your own research a very clear reason and response to what it is that this science fiction literature offers, what it is that these fantasy science fiction elements offer to the perspective of what you are doing in your work. And that way, whenever anybody responds to you with, well, why would you do this when you can just read this popular technical journal instead? Well, because technical journals don't offer X, Y, and Z in the kind of perspective that a piece of science fiction literature does. And to have that clearly stated is important, I think.
I definitely ran into that with my dissertation, because I was writing on, I was looking at delivery from classical rhetoric, and I was talking about performativity. And so what I used for my example to discuss everything from classical delivery to current was Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. And my committee, some of my committee in particular, wanted to know why on earth I was using Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. And they said, well, it's breaking boundaries in the way that I'm discussing with post-human theory. I mean, you've got something that's, you know, created to be a video blog and acts as such and is first released on your computer, and then you get it on a DVD. What's the difference in viewing it in those two different formats was one of the things I was talking about. I said, find me something else. Find me some Shakespeare that's done that. Like, I clearly need to use, you know, this particular film, web series film thing. See, you can't even really define it.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote recently, last year, I presented at a conference in Birmingham, England, that was about artificial intelligence and machine ethics. Now, in this room, when I say artificial intelligence, machine ethics, and the ethics of perhaps created life, you think about Isaac Asimov, you think about the three laws, you think about the creature in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And those things are obvious, immediate parallels to you. But when I use that as a reference point to show that these stories have always existed, and when I then take those stories and then arc them back several hundred years to the story of the Golem of Prague, when I take the Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles universe and combine all of those things together and show that there is a thematic conceptual element throughout all of this science fiction literature, throughout all of the science fiction media, that holds these things together in our minds and acts as a cautionary tale, but one that's actually kind of more of a self-fulfilling prophecy than any kind of cautionary tale, because they're stories we're telling ourselves, so they don't have to come true that way. Making that clear to people without then having to also reference, you know, Michel Foucault and normalization theory, and then having to bring in the idea of Mircea Eliade's Eternal Return of Stories, and bringing in all of these more reputable academic elements. Talk about Shakespeare instead. Talk about, you know, this theorist. Talk about that theorist. It's a fight. But you can make the case by doing the work. And it sometimes might feel like one of the things that I like to do, and it's kind of mean, but it gets the job done, is to describe not this thing, but to describe the narrative, to tell the heart of the story, what the story is and what it does. and then to reveal what that is. I just talked to you about the Foundation series. I just talked to you about, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's Odyssey. I just talked to you about, you know, the TV series Person of Interest. You love the idea of the ethics of non-human personhood when you were just thinking of it in these abstract theoreticals, but there's an actual show out there, there's an actual book series that deals with these themes, and I want to discuss it. If I told you that first, you would have reacted in a completely different way. You need to understand why that's unacceptable. And then putting that to them that way makes them have to completely recontextualize and rethink how they categorize what's viable, acceptable sources to reference and to bring into the work.
And in some ways, I mean, we are getting, there's journals like the Journal of Popular Culture, mm-hmm. which is a huge journal that's got a circulation of something like over 3,000.
Yes.
Which, I mean, and in academia, that's like
that's
a
big.
Huge deal.
That's pretty big.
The Journal of American Culture, which is slightly smaller. We've got the Studies in Popular Culture, mm-hmm. which is another journal. And so we're getting more and more of this foundation of, I guess, legitimacy for this as a field.
Right.
And I think comic studies has done, has helped tremendously, because with the popularization of comic studies, it's really making studies in science fiction and fantasy become, generate more interest, and it's really paving the way.
Yeah.
Because you can get tons and tons of readers on how to teach comics, using comics in your classroom, comic literacy, and that's starting to follow up with the same sorts of things for science fiction, the history of science fiction. There was an excellent recent book talking about the history of science fiction that traces it back to the ancient Greeks, which is fairly recent. I think it's 2010 that came out. And now I can't remember the author, but if you, you know, Google the history of science fiction, it will come up.
Yeah, and the ancient Greeks did have, you know, like stories of clockwork automata. You look at, you know, the minions of Hephaestus. You have the first robots. You have the first created intelligences designed to do this work. And that theme then becomes pulled forward into, you know, Czech mindsets in the 1850s. And then you have that brought forward into our understanding of robots, and that colors completely Asimov's recognition of, well, if we're going to have these what are literally, etymologically, literally a slave race, created slaves, what does that mean that they must not be able to do? How are they programmed? How are they made so that they don't then look at their servitude and hate us? And these kind of ethical implications, yeah, they've existed for thousands of years. And you mentioned the idea of, you know, comic studies and science fiction literature studies working together. It brings to my mind the fact that these are the two areas that have dealt with this question of legitimacy for the longest. Science fiction has, if you look at representation, if you look at its placement in the wider media, in the wider pop culture, there has always been some science fiction on TV, some science fiction in the theaters, some science fiction on the bookshelves, period. Always has been. But at the same time and in the same breath, people will say, but science fiction isn't real literature. Science fiction doesn't make real discussion. It doesn't bring real theory to the, and you have that, how, if science fiction isn't real literature, if science fiction doesn't have a real impact on how people understand the world, on how people view themselves, on how people behave, why is it everywhere? Why do people constantly seek it out? Why do we constantly retell stories from different angles? Why do we try to envision new worlds, worlds that we never thought of before, to try and make and build our way toward? Without, in a very real way, without Ray Bradbury, we would not have the world in which we live today. Without Arthur C. Clarke, we would not have satellite communications technology at the time that we had it. Without a science fiction author writing a science fiction story, we would not have a space shuttle program. These things color our understanding. They color our world. And they directly impact how we engage it. And I think that is becoming more and more accepted and more legitimized. But there are still that area of pushback where people, for instance, one of the most well-known examples of this, Margaret Atwood's refusal to take on the label of science fiction. If you look at the book or the series now, the Mad Atom trilogy, starting with Oryx and Crake, moving to In the Year of the Flood, and now the last one that's about to come out is Mad Atom. This is a trilogy that is a science fiction trilogy at its heart. It is, if basically the way I like to think about it is, if you look at William Gibson's cyberpunk future, where they talk about the arcologies that have fallen apart, these domed cities in which corporations and corporate housing and corporate workers all lived and worked and played, and some of them have fallen apart, but some of them have basically walled themselves off into their own little kingdoms. Looking at that in the Mad Atom trilogy, it's basically as if you were seeing that from the inside. If you were seeing it as a member of the arcology and what had, what was happening to the outside world. And you see them, like these people, go out into the world, go out into the slums, as they call it, and you basically see these glimpses of William Gibson's Neuromancer trilogy out in the world, that these people are like, let's go slum it, let's go hang out, we're going to inject ourselves with some, some nice cocktails of immunizations, and we're going to go out, we're going to slum it up, and we're going to come back, live in our domed walled city, and never think about these people again. But Margaret Atwood, even for all of these elements and for all of these things, refuses to take on science fiction because she felt, distinctly said at one point, that it would, that the genre label delegitimizes literature. And as long as people think of it in that way, think about that delegitimization as being possible simply by the label of genre, by the label of science fiction fantasy, we have a problem that we need to combat in making people understand that no matter what you call it, we call it science fiction because it's fiction about science. You have to be able to recognize that element as being primary, as being part of what the key is. That label shouldn't cause you to want to take a step away from it. It should make you want to run toward it. Do you have any other things you wanted to specifically note, or do you want to open it up for questions?
Maybe for questions. I think you just gave me a paper idea. Because I was thinking about that, and Anne McCaffrey fought so hard to be labeled a science fiction writer. And I consider Anne McCaffrey the grandmother of science fiction in a lot of ways. I mean, she's the uber feminist of science fiction. She was the first woman to win everything.
Yeah.
And write the first deliberately feminist science fiction novel. And she insisted that she was a science fiction writer, but Margaret Atwood doesn't want to be called a science fiction writer. What does that say about the progression of feminism?
Yeah.
Kind of.
That's a very, that is a very interesting, looking at it from a feminist literary theory, that is actually a very interesting problem. What does this, the acceptance and the, in fact, seeking after of the label indicate in contrast with the denial of the label itself as a whole? Your question in the back, and then you up front.
I've met with girls, the technologist, and it's a historical fiction based over MIT. And it's really quite interesting how Harvard actually did not like MIT and felt threatened by it, and they did not like technology at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very threatened by it and so forth. They were fighting against it because they were, they did not understand it at that point in time in our history.
Yes.
And so forth, and it was a mystery and so forth involved, but all the elements of history were all involved in there, and even though it was a mystery, it had that element over everybody still being threatened by the progression over technology, and I think that's what a lot of people are still afraid over when you think of science fiction, because it tells about the progression over man in technology and how far we can go and push the envelope and things like that. That how far are we willing to do this?
I think you're very right about that, that that is something that for some reason still really worries people. You know, I mentioned Ray Bradbury earlier. Think about the unfortunate past he had with Rod Serling and The Twilight Zone. Think about what ended up happening with the Outer Limits, the original Outer Limits series. These were all seen as these extraordinary cautionary tales of don't go too fast or go too far. And once again, even reaching back to the ancient Greeks, you look at Icarus and Daedalus. You know, that's a science fiction tech story. That's a human augmentation story. I figured out a way to give us wings. I figured out a way to make us able to fly. However, you really need to be careful with this, because there's a thing with the sun and the wax. Anyway, don't worry about it. Just don't go too high. And it's all about, always, in these instances, about hubris. It's about, oh, man has tread where man was not meant to tread. We know too much. Kaboom. And that's, I think that that's, there's a lot of pushback in especially recent science fiction against that idea, that it doesn't have to be, oh, we know too much, but it has to be about, what don't we know? What do we need to figure out before we make this attempt? I mean, think about if Daedalus had just said, you know, if you seal the wax on these wings, you can go a bit higher. I know you want to fly high. Here's what you do in order to do that. Not just don't go up there. But if you really, really want to, here are the problems with it, and here's what could happen if you do.
Reminds me of Plato, because Plato said, you know, writing is awful. Like, he said we shouldn't write, and I think it's Gorgias. He says writing is going to destroy everything.
Yes.
And it's going to rot your mind. Because
yep.
You'll never be able to remember anything because you won't have to. Because yep. You'll write it all down. So, you know,
you gotta
help with this writing stuff. It reminds me of like, oh, don't text. Texting ruins writing. Like, it's terrible. Like, we can't do any of this text stuff.
Cell phones have really hit your memory hard.
Well, mm-hmm. It changes the way that we remember. And I think that even going to Plato, following that train, you're going to lose your memory. You're going to lose your ability. Memory houses back in the ancient Greek. You had these ways to remember things, these situational things. Writing will ruin that. Texting will ruin it. The internet will ruin it. Doesn't ruin it. It puts it outside of ourselves. And that might be problematic in a number of ways. But it doesn't. It makes us mediated from our memory. It doesn't remove our memories.
It kind of reduces some of the memory skills.
Right. I mean, that's a different problem.
You know your own home phone number now?
I actually still remember my home phone number from when I was a child.
Yeah, not the one from when you were a kid, but what's your phone number? It's number one on the cell phone.
I also try not to use the speed dial as much as possible. But, I mean, there's always, because of the way that the human brain architecture works, there's always that trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, as you were saying about Plato, even going back that far, we have always been, unfortunately, more willing to see the trade as a loss rather than ask what potential gains can be made and what can be done to mitigate the losses.
Which really, I mean, talking about like science fiction studies and like science fiction and fantasy scholarship, like I immediately tend to go into this place of like, you know, studying literature, studying, you know, television and film and things like that and looking at cultural studies. But look at what we're doing in like neurophilosophy and neuropsychology. Isn't that science fiction studies?
Getting there.
Yeah, it's getting there. Did you hear about the brain-to-brain interface that happened just this past week? Brain-to-brain interface. Human beings linked on a brain interface, able to work each other's limbs by sending signals into each other's brains. It was kind of jittery, but it got there.
Actually, I went to the panel at the science fiction.
Yes.
One of the guys, he was, in 2005, he was able to take a memory from a rat
mm-hmm.
and create some brain waves from another rat. So it was able to do a task that only the other rat knew how to do.
Yep. Being able to transfer neurological states from one to the other is something we can do. We can resolve to a kind of a grainy degree, dream imagery. That is science fiction. But at the same time, science fiction has always had that concurrent development, that back and forth with life. I mean, again, these are the stories we tell ourselves about the world that we are either trying to make or trying to avoid. Human augmentation, again, that's one of the things that I focus on. Cybernetics. The field of cybernetics would not exist without science fiction stories about cybernetics. I mean, they were a different kind of thing, but the idea of a system, of a loop, a feedback loop of inputs and outputs that I could control internally, be it chemical or electrical or biomechanical, that's cybernetics. It's making cybernetic organisms. And without science fiction stories that talked about that idea first, people would not have that idea to try and actually develop into something workable. Jorge Luis Borges wrote The Garden of Forking Paths. And I don't know if any of you, you know, are fans of the many worlds theorem of quantum mechanics, but the idea has been said that without Borges's Garden of Forking Paths, many worlds theorem never would have been discovered. Like, the math that makes that work would not have been thought about. It's all about the stories that we tell ourselves and the world in which we live and how we then use those stories to think about the world. And being able to do that in an academic context is necessary. Being able to talk about how those things feed each other. Not just for our own benefit, because we obviously love it. We obviously really enjoy it. But I think it's necessary for everybody.
Like when I taught American Lit, I would start my my survey course with Million Year Picnic, the last story of the Martian Chronicles.
Mm. Mm.
And so we would start there, and then we would talk about alien invasion movies, and then we would talk about colonizing America and committing genocide against the Native Americans. I mean, how much of our alien invasion filmmaking and story writing is just guilt? I mean, why wouldn't that be, you know, white European descendants' biggest fear? Like, because that's what they did. Like, hey, we want this land. See ya. And that's what it seems that aliens are going to come do to America, like, any minute.
Yeah. Like, all of the worries we have are about that exact thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I haven't researched it myself. Maybe you guys can tell me more about it. But it feels like a lot of what is classic sci-fi or even fantasy that is considered valid literary content today, Lord of the Rings, Mary Shelley, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, all of these things, at the time they were published, weren't anything more than a fun book to read. But over the time, enough scholars have pointed out the valid content and the valid ideals and ideologies contained therein, and have turned it into literarily accepted books. And perhaps you guys are doing the same thing for the next generation of literature, for Dr. Horrible to become, you know, a valid literary reference for 5 years, 10 years, maybe 50 years down the road.
Great. Well, and it's still, I mean, things like Frankenstein are even still debated. I mean, people still debate, did Percy Bysshe Shelley write this?
Yep.
Like, who's the real author? Could a woman possibly have written something like this? Like, I mean, and it still gets, it still gets hotly debated. And it's interesting, too, looking at things. I mean, you'll see, like scholarship and courses on, you know, Tolkien. Mm-hmm. But you'll also see something like Fahrenheit 451 will be, like, required reading in high schools. But once you get into college, where's your Ray Bradbury?
Right.
Like, why is Ray Bradbury not in the Norton Anthology? Like, come on.
For real. I mean, the skill and the level and mastery of language in Ray Bradbury's literature, it should be recognized in every American history, every American literature course, just hands down. But as you note, it's always a slog. It's always this, no, I have to show you, I have to chip away at this, I have to bring this to your attention and let you understand the thematic importances, the context of the work, the theoretical implications for the ideas that this author brings up.
Like the sociopolitical context in most of Dune.
Exactly.
It's as much a like political fight as it is a sci-fi novel.
Absolutely, and it's still a relevant one today.
Have you read The Unincorporated Man? It's a recent novel. I can't remember who the author is at this point.
It sounds familiar. I don't think I have read.
But it is a very sci-fi tale to kick off, but spends the entire book not espousing, but covering the pros, cons, and societal repercussions of a completely different economic system. But it's presented as just sci-fi. All
right.
One of the things that's cool looking at the canon, whether you're talking about the canon of literature or the canon of film or any sort of canon that you want to make into a canon, and looking at science fiction studies, is it's such a young field and there's so much to be done. Like, getting involved in this kind of work really lets you shape it and make those things. Like, looking at like Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, well, Buffy's studies and Whedon's studies make Whedon such a large part of this. Well, we have, you know, Norton Whedon. I mean, will there be a film Norton in film classes? Like, I never took any sort of film or TV courses, which makes me sad still. But whatever sort of equivalent there would be in that, I mean, is Buffy's studies going to take over the world? Because that's where a lot of scholarship is. I mean, what can we do to get Ray Bradbury in there and Anne McCaffrey and Frank Herbert and everybody?
Yeah.
Really? Because the Norton's weird.
Norton is weird. They make a lot of strange choices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You had your hand up.
Yes. And I think the whole idea of science fiction as not literature, not good enough, is the whole populist aspect of it, because that's just anyone able to write sci-fi, and it's kind of the people, sort of thing. And that's not, there's a need to be gelled with the whole, you know, ivory tower sort of situation we often get in education. So it's hard to get science fiction and other cool stuff to have good reputation without. It's not like necessarily from someone with like a PhD or from like that kind of background, even though it has viable information.
Vicky, working in library sciences, like working as you do, you have actually probably the best relationship with the populace of any academic institution. I work in philosophy, and when I was doing my graduate research in philosophy, there was a big, big thing about doing so-called folk intuitions, like talking about the folk, the people, the hoi polloi, is basically what the implication of this is.
The great unwashed
masses. Like, these people that don't know anything. Let's see what they think about this idea. Because we've studied and thought about it from these perspectives, and we obviously have really nice ideas, but let's see what the people think. It's, even if it's not intended as such a condescending idea, that's what it works out to be. And it's that kind of populism that you talk about, that kind of general ideology of, you know, people enjoying this being a good book to read that you discussed earlier. These things are exactly why we shouldn't look at them as, oh, what do the people think? But what do people think? What are people thinking about? Because they are the people that are thinking about this, that are dealing with this every day.
And one of the things that you find, too, is I think higher education is becoming more and more problematic. And I think it's because the ivory tower is breaking down. It's not, but it is, like, that exclusive sort of place that people are going to go. I mean, did you guys hear of or read or know any, like, Academically Adrift, the book that came out that caused, like, all this crazy furor because it was talking about how colleges are becoming more administrative than faculty. Like, the administrative sections of colleges have grown. Colleges have become more expensive because it's supporting all of this stuff, like not just your rec center, but your career center and your you're all of these other things, and your faculty is really, you, generally speaking of your college, your faculty is only about 30% at this point of the population of everybody that works at the college.
Yep.
And that's like kind of large.
Yep.
That's about how much tuition covers, what it draws in. I mean, it's getting crazy, and the amount of money that it takes to just even, I mean, it's always been expensive, but now it's getting
ridiculous.
Yeah, like one of the things the book is talking about is college is becoming more and more of an upper class phenomenon,
right.
And everything that we've been doing was trying to prevent that from happening and make it accessible, but is it really accessible, and what's going on?
To the point where you're either rich or you're lower class and you're being given help from the government.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the middle, you're on your own, and most people can't afford it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that, I think, is where you see the rise in different versions of it. Like MIT, you can now audit any class at MIT online for free.
Yep. And then that's, I mean, you can't, they don't yet have it, you know, the ability to actually gain a full degree out of it, but you can still learn the same amount of things.
You have the same amount of knowledge, you just don't have
this piece of paper. Exactly. Precisely.
And you've got the, with the MOOCs,
mm-hmm.
like coming through and all of that sort of thing. So, I mean, looking at things that are, like, I guess more popular or for, you know, everyone, how much of that, I mean, I don't know what's going on. The barrier, something's happening here, but maybe that's making it more accessible, or maybe it's making it less accessible.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you think that with the rise in technological advances, and particularly as this younger generation grows up with these new advances and that continues to happen, that there will be more of a place for sci-fi in higher education and in the general literature community that will be taken more seriously in the coming years?
That, I really don't know. One of the things that seemed to me that with the more options that we had with technology didn't necessarily mean that anybody knew what to do with it.
Hmm.
You have students that are coming in that have always been surrounded with technology, but they can use a word, they can use Word. They can check their email, and they can get on Facebook and do whatever, like Vine or whatever new thing is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And Google. But that's not, it's not like that they know how it works. And one of the things that was kind of traumatizing for me teaching was we had all this stuff available in the classroom, but I had no idea what any of it was. I just had boxes of things with buttons and knobs on it. And I was like, I'm trying to figure out how to turn on the projector. Like, I've got a YouTube clip. Like, the Wi-Fi goes out. And I'm like, what are we doing? So I just gave up and started writing on the board again. And I was like, well, at least I know this is here. But then someone would steal all your dry erase markers, so that didn't work either.
Always. Always, always.
I mean, so it runs into, like I don't know. I think, and with that, you end up with this kind of, like, Jonathan Edwards Enlightenment, like, push against it, where it's like, we must be more traditional than ever, because there's, you know, there's Facebook. No one should ever use Facebook or have some sort of online environment for a discussion thread. That's crazy.
Right.
So it's weird. I don't know how it's going to end up playing out. There's too many, it's like there's too many tides right now.
For lack of a better term, academic management, not being really able to really understand the concept.
That's a lot of possibility as well. But as Vicky says, the idea of, you know, people who are surrounded by technology as they grow but don't investigate that technology, who accept the generally prescribed use of this technology and go no further with it. That's not everyone, but that is a lot of people. Here's this thing, this is how it works, use it this way. And people say, okay. The only place you're going to see true investment in technology, the only place you're going to see people who do radically different things with technology, this guy named Joshua Ellis is actually working on investigating disruptive technologies in the third world, because his belief is that the only place you're going to see a truly disruptive technology come about is in a place where it has to, where a change must be made, where something radically different has to be done or people are going to die. As we currently stand, you know, whatever else you want to say about American culture, we think we are living very comfortably. And so we don't do much different with the tech that we have. We make modifications and alterations to what we have, but we don't do different things. And until different things are done, it's just going to be another iteration of, here's a Facebook page, here's Word. I know people who have literally grown up with, you know, I teach people who've grown up with Word for their entire lives. They've never used any other, they've never had to, you know, write by hand a thing, or, you know, heaven forbid, use one of those word processing typewriters with a little weird gray-green screen. And they don't know how to make use of the footnote program in Microsoft Word, or how to create a page break without hitting enter 7 times. It's like I'm giving, at the same time as I'm giving content, I'm also giving critiques on, by the way, if you need to make this thing happen in the format or the structure of your paper, feel free to hit these 2 buttons in combination. Like, it's and these are people that have never had anything else, who've always had this stuff. Hold on. She had her hand up, and then you, and then you.
Okay. So y'all have talked a lot about how academia is increasingly disassociated from the real world, both in the everyday sense and in terms of what the folk think.
Right.
Do you feel that popular culture studies are a little more grounded in social justice for that reason? I mean, like, Star Trek owns the first interracial kiss on television. Buffy owns the first normative lesbian relationship, and then there's like District 9,
yep,
and a lot of other material. Do you feel that that translates into not necessarily activism, but a greater interest in the practicality of what's happening in social justice in the world?
I grew up reading Anne McCaffrey in particular, and then branched out, and that was really my entry point into science fiction, as I desperately looked for female role models. Where can I find female characters that can, you know, lead and think and do stuff, and they're just not like barefoot in the kitchen and stuff. And thinking about this, I think that science fiction has pushed, like, has opened up like gender and possibilities, for example. But one of the things that I had thought, and I'm still not sure where I stand on this, was that's still more true in science fiction than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Like, I still, like, I'm watching commercials, like commercials from the 80s, you could have these girls playing with Legos, and now there are no more Legos for girls, apparently, unless they're pink.
Right.
Yeah, there's all this, like, atrocious, like, backwards stuff happening. So is it saying, like, here's a realm where this can happen, or is this really, I mean, or I can't decide if it's really empowering or really depressing. Like, only in imagining alternate universes can women be powerful,
right,
as opposed to in, like, our actual reality? Or is it opening up avenues for women to be powerful again as our society keeps fluctuating back and forth with what is acceptable? And I think it goes for, like, any sort of marginalization or ostracization, not just, you know, looking at gender here, but which... I think it's a door that swings kind of both ways, maybe.
I don't know
if that answers your question.
I think that the thing you mentioned earlier, when we look at the kind of Jonathan Edwards Enlightenment era, when we talk about that, what we're saying is that during the Enlightenment Reformation in the 1700s and 1800s, there was a really big anti-science pushback from a lot of people who wanted to say, no, with all of these new things that we have found, we must go more heavily into an uninquisitive, unintellectualized theology. And I think that you see that kind of thing anytime the status quo is shifted. Because while I still believe that disruptive technologies as a whole will find most of their root in places it's necessary, I think that new thoughts, new ways of trying to engage the system as it exists will be sought by those of us who have been disenfranchised by said system often. But there's also going to then, anytime those grounds are made, anytime somebody like Anne McCaffrey comes along, anytime somebody like Mary Shelley comes along, anytime somebody like Gail Simone comes along, anytime somebody like Elizabeth Baer comes along, there's going to be pushback.
Then the Westboro Baptist Church comes along.
Right, and they're like, no. And then, like, even if they're not the majority, they're a very, very vocal minority. And that vocalization of that minority colors what other people are willing to stand up and clamor for, what they're willing to stand up and say they want and is good. So I think that a lot of social justice ideas, a lot of work toward equality does find itself in science fiction, because in a way, as we've discussed, it kind of flies under, like, both in the populace and under the radar of, you know, ask a politician what they think about science fiction and you're going to get a blank stare. But that's a space to start doing real work and laying real groundwork. But it shouldn't have to be that way, as you were saying?
There was actually, I read this a couple of months ago. It was a Republican senator, I think, in West Virginia, because this was sent to me, that was trying to make science fiction required reading in high school. Did anybody read this? As a push to, like...
That one I haven't heard.
This one, it was a Republican, like a Republican politician that was pushing for required reading of science fiction in high school in order to generate interest in STEM, which is science...
Science, technology.
It was the argument was that the science fiction would spur the imaginations of kids and get them interested to go into these fields.
You see things about the space program, and you've got these guys that design the spacecraft, and they say, I watched Star Trek.
Exactly.
And I got inspired, or I read Heinlein as a kid,
yep.
And I got inspired. That's what brought me into that era.
Yeah, and for the for the generation just previous to that, it's, Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke,
yep.
I read... Children of the Earth, and I needed it.
Destination Moon.
Right,
yeah.
I needed this. Absolutely. That I had not heard of, that being done by a Republican senator yet.
Well,
that
makes me very happy. Because I was what is the Republican senator reading because of social justice?
Right.
There's going to be so much other things that could happen from this.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking as a quasi-Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarian with a small L.
Okay.
The ones that make the most noise are not representative of all Republicans.
Precisely. Just like the Westboro Baptist Church is not representative of all Christians.
Exactly.
But they are.
Well, that knucklehead down in Florida.
They are extraordinarily vocal,
yeah.
And that by being vocal, those Christians and those Republicans who don't share those views don't really kind of go, hey, we don't share these views as often as they ought.
That on me.
They just kind of put their head down and hope nobody sees them sitting next to them.
Yeah.
That's not enough. I think a real thing that we need to do in, academics, in science fiction, in, as our engagement with the world, in our fields, and in our, the things we enjoy widens and deepens, is to be willing to say, no, I don't think of this way. Don't think that because I have these particular ideas, I also have to have these particular ideas. That doesn't work that way. I have these ideas. Here are my ideas. Here's what I think science fiction can do. Here's what I think academia can do. Here's what I think everyone needs to do with these things in order to make a better world. And I mean, that sounds hokey, but I really do think that in a very real sense, a lot of science fiction tries to get us to make a better world.
At least think about one.
I've kind of lost track of the line. I think you're next, and then you.
Three. Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't like Word. And the reason why I don't like Word is that I could not maneuver it to do what I had to do. I use Word perfect. I know Word, but I use Word perfect.
Yes.
Because I like to reveal codes, and I can put organic compounds into my notes.
Yes.
Quite easily. Okay. The second comment is, just recently, the military is going to allow women officially to be warriors.
Yeah, in combat positions.
In combat positions.
Yes.
And then you think to a movie like Starship Troopers, where they were.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Look at the book Starship Troopers, where not only were women in combat positions, but they were the only pilots. Like, right. In order to be a pilot in the Heinlein universe, you had to be female, because it was basically...
G's better than that.
Yep,
tonight.
And your physiological, like, the framework of your body was better made to fly in both space and atmospheric conditions. They're like, men can't do this. They won't be able to.
Physiologically, women make better shooters.
Exactly.
The Russian military in World War II used hundreds of female snipers.
Right. And these are things that are true. They have nothing to do with the worth of the person based on some physiological aspect. It has to do with these things are what our body, our general body shape and body types as male or female allow us to do. Or as, you know, biologically male or female allow us to do. Whether you then have to do that? No, not necessarily. But we're going to request more female snipers and more female pilots because they'll be baseline better at it. we can get a guy to be a better sniper, sure, but we're going to have to work him better. We're going to have to make him better. We can just get a woman and she will baseline be better. Why not? And then you ask yourself, why not? Why hasn't that happened? Why has it taken such a fight to get women in combat positions?
Well, it's again along the lines of segregation and integration.
Right.
Okay, they're afraid that if women are on the combat line, they're going to integrate with the men.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fraternization.
Forced to do it.
Right. Fraternization of the troops.
You know, and so what?
Right.
If both parties decide that that's what they want to do,
right.
It ain't none of your business.
Exactly.
So the thing is, women in combat, as long as they have to meet the same basic levels of fitness and such, mm-hmm. I have no problem with a female SEAL, but you better pass buds.
The same way
any man does.
Because that's a job that requires
that much physical strength and stamina.
Yeah, and I think that it shouldn't be, it should not be placed in the context of, well, a man can do X, so the woman must do X. It should be, what will this job ultimately...
What does this job require?
Right. But the problem is that it then becomes... A man can do X, so a woman must do X, and that becomes the stamp that gets placed on the whole.
Well, in a way, that's you got to do that.
Not necessarily.
There are certain roles in combat that require certain physical attributes.
But at the same time, and this actually goes back to a lot of what I discuss in regards to how science fiction and life interplay off of each other. Why do they require that? Because those are the roles that we have devised for the military. Why have we devised those roles for the military? Because down through history, we've put men in combat positions. Why have we put men in combat positions? Because we've traditionally thought about men as being those who fight. We haven't thought about the women as those who fight and put them in those positions. If you start off from a position of women in more combat positions, you start to think about the necessities of war and the necessities of battle in a different way. That is, you'd start to do different things.
What you look at is, say, a tank crew.
Sorry, say again?
A tank crew. Hmm? You have to be able to physically lift.
Right, but that's because we built tanks in such a way that men would...
That's the way they are.
No, well, that's nothing is just the way it is. Nothing is.
Oh well, we need these heavy.
That's the thing.
It requires this much physical strength, which requires with the materials we got. It requires this much weight.
What I'm saying is that
you need to do this job, you need to lift this much weight.
What I'm saying is that nothing is simply the way it is. The structures of our societies cause us to think of these situations in particular ways, that these certain people will be in these situations, and thus it will be the case that, yes, certain things will be a particular weight because they're made out of a particular material. Mm-hmm. Like a tank shell weighs as much as a tank shell weighs.
Yep.
However, if you think about the scenario where from the beginning of, let's call it pre-World War I, we live in a world where women are in more combat positions. Mm-hmm. There will then be this fact that there is this tank shell. Women are in combat positions. Some woman is going to have to run a tank because some woman's going to have to run a tank. We just have that many people that need to be in tanks. What will we need to be able to get that tank? If that woman, for whatever reason, or if that crewman, for whatever reason, cannot lift that tank shell, somebody's going to devise a system that allows the tank shell to be loaded. somebody's going to devise, sorry, second?
Or a better tank shell.
Or a better tank shell, or better materials, or something. When we start to think of it as it is this way, because it has been this way, that prevents us from then thinking, well, what if it had been a different way? What might we have done instead? What might we have learned or devised if a different situation or scenario had been in place?
A previous panelist was the first woman fireman.
Firefighter.
That's the accepted term.
In this town, and was not graciously accepted until the men figured out that if she were lighter, she could go on roofs that were less secure.
Mm-hmm.
And if she were smaller, she could go into areas which they could not fit.
Right.
Still required to carry the same amount of equipment and everything else.
Right.
But it was to their advantage.
Right. And it changes the way they have to think about what a firefighting tactic is. Because up to that point, firefighting tactics are, you go into a building, you check X, Y, and Z for stresses, and if these stresses exist, you don't go that way. But if your crewman, if your firefighter is lighter, is more agile, then that route becomes more accessible. These things open up as avenues which aren't previously available. I hate to cut this off. I want to get to one last question, and then unfortunately we are a bit over time and we do need to go. So I'm sorry to cut everybody off, but I do want to spend more time talking to you guys, but we do have to wrap it up.
As a classic gifted with no motivation type of student growing up, something I've seen a lot in academia that's personally thrown me off, and I wonder if you guys have seen the same thing, is a lot of the harking back to what you said about Plato, that writing is terrible, it destroys your ability to think. Do you think academia has become self-perpetuating in their lack of ability to accept technology?
Yes.
I have the ability to, instead of memorize all the material the professor gives me, know exactly where the references are for that same material on my human augmentation, the internet.
Right.
And yet in so many classes still, or environments, your ability to reference information is not important. Your ability to arbitrarily memorize becomes important.
Well, yeah, but...
And do you think, is that changing?
Well, I want to... Vicky, if you want to go ahead with that, I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I took a class in Old English when I first started my program, and my professor, who was fantastic, she was amazing. She had us engaged in Monty Python references, but she made us memorize. We would have translation exercises from Old English to English, and we would have to memorize the Old English. So we would go through and do Dream of the Rood, and we'd have to translate it for an exam with no book. And she said, no Old English scholar will ever translate cold like this. You will never use this, but this is how I was taught Old English, so now you have to do it. Like, so going through and doing it without using the book, without doing references, because that was how you did Old English scholarship. You memorized, you know, all, like, 38, like, pronoun forms or whatever. Cool. I did. It was like, wow. I mean, it was cool, but so I see, like, there's still very much... academia seems to make concessions, like PowerPoint is very much, I feel like, an academic concession. Now, nobody's going to teach you anywhere in academia, much like no one will teach you how to get up in front of students and teach them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not, you walk into class on the first day, and I didn't tell them who I was or what the class was for or anything. I just started talking to them. Like, there was nothing, because no one had ever taught me how to actually interact with a group of 25 students sitting there waiting for information.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's why nowadays we get people specializing in pedagogy. How do we teach? Because nobody ever taught me how to teach. What do we do here?
You cannot be taught how to
teach. To an extent, you can be taught the technical aspects of it, but if you don't have it, you don't have it. Like, after a while, you recognize if you are in an investment to teach. But I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Well, it's the exact same thing. I mean, you're encouraged to use all of this tech in your classroom or to use PowerPoint, but nobody ever teaches you how to do it.
Well, like, and I work as a linguist myself, and one of the keys that I had to find was learning that you can't just give somebody words in another language and now they speak the language.
Right.
You have to teach them how to take an idea that you understand and change the idea into a different form of expression, which is the heart of teaching, if it's done correctly, is taking a concept that you know from your academia and being able to phrase it so that we can understand it.
Precisely. And that's the key to, I think, learning and the expression of learning as a whole. You say that you're not as good at the memorization of things, but you are good at the referencing of things. What I think is that the actual act of displaying to me that you have learned doesn't matter in either of those cases. I want to know that you know your references because I want to know you know your references. That's a thing that I do want you to know. I don't want you to be able to just spout things at me because that doesn't tell me you've learned anything. I want you to be able to use it. I want you to be able to put those ideas into a context and display to me an understanding. That is when you have learned a thing. And whether you do that with the things that you've memorized or whether you do that with the things you know how to reference, I don't care. But you show me that you've learned something, and we'll go from there.
I think students are pushing the envelope. Because, I mean, I would be teaching, and I'd be writing all over the whiteboard, and I will never forget. Like, I've been, you know, doing all this stuff all class, like, all over the place. And then after class, a student just came up, click, and
yep.
left.
It's like,
and
done.
I was like, well, all right.
I have a professor that had a solution for that. He wrote with this hand and erased with this
hand. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been absolutely wonderful to have you here. Thank you once again. Let's give a big hand to Vicky. Give yourselves a hand. Thank you very much for your questions. We really appreciate it. Once again, I have the information for the Comics and Popular Arts Academic Conference up here, our website, our Facebook page, and our Twitter account if you want to find out more about us and what we do.
And submit papers.
Be the first to know when our call for papers goes out so that you can be up here doing this thing perhaps. Please come follow us online, and we will be happy to inform you about when our next call goes out. We got to go ahead and clear out, but if you want to talk to us, we can hang around for a little bit longer. Thank you again.